Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and this is the 97th episode of the podcast titled Revolution Z. Suppose you find capitalist globalization, or any other systemic oppression, horrific. You reject rewriting the rules of international exchange to further enrich the already rich and to further empower the already powerful. But how can you direct your personal energies to impact such an immense process as globalization, or racism, or sexism, or exploitation, or authoritarianism? How can individuals transcend futile whining? How can we improve lives now? How can we bring nearer a truly liberated social commonwealth in our future? When we pursue radical politics, most of us come to a point when we try to examine society and its dynamics, understand something about agents of change, and figure out how we can act upon the world to make it better. So, to start, we have to get a feeling about society. Such feelings rely on facts, such as that if you made $200,000 a day, 5 days a week, it would take you more than 300 years to earn as much as Bill Gates is worth, even if his wealth didn't grow in the meantime. At a lower, but still barely imaginable level, when Michael Jordan was last playing professional basketball with the Chicago Bulls, before he became the owner of the Washington Wizards, he made $300,000 per game, and, with endorsements, roughly $150,000 per day. Assuming Jordan slept 7 hours a night, he was making about $52,000 while he slept. While he attended an average movie, he made $12,550. While eating a meal, he made about $5,000. Yet even Michael Jordan would have had to save everything he made from his income at that high rate for more than 100 years to attain the current net worth of Bill Gates. That gives you some grasp of income distribution in the United States, as long as we remember that the huge masses of people for whom a minuscule fraction of these type incomes would be grounds for virtually unlimited celebration. Other relevant facts include that U.S. society fosters nearly 100,000 reported rapes yearly, with perhaps 10 times that number going unreported. Black infant mortality in the United States is a bit over twice that of whites. U.S. society engenders one successful suicide every 40 seconds. In the United States, capitalist firms spend $240 billion every year to advertise to people who have what's called discretionary income, which is roughly 17% of the population, while the rest of the population is disposable. The United States has 3 million people without homes to sleep in, though it has roughly 50,000 hotels that are generally only about half full and are able to house 15 million people. The United States includes working people who profoundly hate the doctors, lawyers, engineers, and managers who lord over them with their high incomes and status and dismissive superiority and arrogance, yet devote their lives to making it possible for their children to become one of those despised agents of authority. The United States has town after town where, in terms of the number of participants, the main social and convivial gathering place is either a bar or an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. This picture of the United States extends abroad as well, to Bolivia with its tin miners who have a life expectancy of 35 years due to the practices of U.S. companies like Alcoa, to India, where 10,000 children a year are going blind, and to the Dominican Republic, where workers earn 25 to 50 cents an hour so that the U.S. multinationals can properly profit and then are repressed or disappeared by local police forces trained by the U.S. military to defend this system of advantage against those who even try to disobey. Around the globe, on the order of 3 million children die each year of starvation and preventable diseases. Awareness of these kinds of horror, not to mention impending ecological calamity, leads many people to oppose injustices and criminality and to seek a world that embodies a more humane logic, with more life-affirming institutions. And when people become moved by that kind of insight, opposition, and aspiration, they begin to try to understand society. Most often nowadays, we begin to conceive of society as a conglomeration of entwined institutions that together interactively create the opportunities or the constraints that largely govern our lives. And the institutions we begin to highlight are of particular types. Economic institutions like corporations and markets, kinship institutions like the nuclear family, cultural institutions like nations, religions, and racial communities, and political institutions like legislatures, courts, and the police. Moving deeper into this oppositional mindset, becoming steadily more aroused against institutional injustices, activists begin to see these structures imposing limits on people's lives as entwined with one another. The institutions become for us, in sum, the preposterously insane thing that we intuitively call the system, as in systemic racism, systemic inequality, or the damn system. We see how the influences from the system's component institutions emanate, mold, and shape each other. So the economy pushes our families, and the way we socialize and interact sexually in our living units, in turn, impacts the economy. Likewise, how we deliberate and make decisions in the polity affects our cultures, and our cultures, in turn, impact our courts and legislatures. And so on, around and around. Economic relations, race relations, gender relations, and political relations each impact the nature and structure of the rest. Each can, and in our society, do reproduce the defining logic of the others. And we see, as well, that these various institutions and derivative structures that mediate our life options also divide us into groups that we need to highlight in our thinking. Classes, gender groups, cultural communities, racial communities, political party advocates, and the like. As we move into a mindset of opposition, we see that these different groups, men and women, gays and straights, Latinos, blacks, Catholics, Jews, politicians, workers, professionals, or coordinators in my preferred lingo, and capitalists generally develop different material and social interests and associated behaviors and consciousnesses based on the effects of the institutions they are molded by. They struggle and contest with each other, with some of these groups located at the bottom of hierarchies in society, while others enjoy great wealth, status, and influence in its uppermost positions. Reaching this point, our unfolded social comprehension is moving clearly leftward, and may gather sufficient momentum and confidence to lead us to try to understand not only more about these defining institutions and their effects on us, but also about alternative institutions able to improve our lives. We may then move on to explore a possible vision we can aspire to, a vision of a world no longer dominated by corporations, markets, and hierarchically defined cultures, families, and states, and without the suffering they impose on us. When we move to find alternatives, we may begin to ask ourselves, how do we accomplish the needed tasks and positive functions that the corporations, markets, states, courts, churches, schools, families, and other institutions in society now address, but in ways that serve people positively? How do we get rid of the bathwater of oppressive institutions and not only keep, but also nurture and fully actualize the baby of needed social functions? When we start to move in this direction, to generate and sustain hope, we may realize that we need to try and decide in more substantial detail what we're for. Here we don't all agree as yet, but one view is that we favor equity, solidarity, diversity, and self-management. The resources, services, and products of human labor should be distributed in a manner that is fair and accords with moral aspirations, as well as getting economic tasks done. The products of our labor should be distributed to people in accord with the effort and sacrifice they put into its creation. Income for how long and how hard people work, and for the harshness of the conditions under which we work. People's circumstances should be comparably pleasant or onerous, rather than some people enjoying superior circumstances and some people suffering from oppressive circumstances. People's circumstances should equally empower, rather than preparing some to dominate and others to be dominated. We should live in a society based on solidarity, in which for us to do better, others have to do better too, instead of living in a society in which for me to do better, somebody else has to do worse. We should have a society in which diversity is not only respected but welcomed and celebrated, because we can all benefit and have richer lives as a result of it. We should live in a society in which people have control over the decisions that determine the character of their lives, and have that control in proportion to how they are affected by those decisions, manifesting their preferences through appropriate participatory structures. If we arrive at desires more or less like the ones I've just described, a question arises. What kinds of institutions would fulfill those values? Here, I think we leftists have been lax, or worse. 50 years ago, we developed movements at a time when oppressed people in the United States self-deprecatingly felt that the suffering and pain they endured were personal problems. Poverty was seen as a personal failing. Being battered was a personal failing. Even being raped was a personal failing. Suffering the indignities of racism, even death, was a personal failing. All these issues were personal. They didn't have a collective dimension for many people. Then movements came along and identified the collective effects, and particularly the collective causes, the social, structural, and institutional causes of these problems. A guy named Michael Harrington wrote a book about poverty called The Other America, making the case that poverty existed and that it wasn't just a question of personal inadequacies, but was widespread and socially caused. That was a very powerful claim, and it had tremendous impact on many people who didn't really see poverty that way until they read The Other America, and met activists teaching that lesson, who awoken them certain hidden truths. Likewise, the women's movement came along and said that the abuses that women suffer from battering, rape, and all manner of abuses, indignities, and denials of their capacity to fulfill themselves weren't a function of the inadequacies of individual women, but were systemic social problems. When women talked to each other about these revelations, often in kitchens and living rooms, they saw that their life experiences were very similar. Not because they all accidentally had the same personal failing, but because their problems were a function of the whole social structure imposing pain on them. When women saw this, it opened their eyes. They became very angry at the injustice of it, and feminist movements awakened. This change in consciousness happened not only about poverty and sexism, but about racism through a civil rights movement that really initiated and was the spine and heart of all the new activism that in turn addressed war and peace, gender, the environment, and later sexuality as well. These were immensely important developments, but the trouble is that for the last 50 years we have been trying to build movements the same way as we did at the outset. Even though everybody already long since knows that the pains of social life are largely systemic. We keep talking about how bad everything is and how problems we identify are systemic, but it is no longer eye-opening to say that the system causes these ills, and it hasn't been for a long time. When the left goes out and communicates to people that society causes these pains and these ills nowadays, we're really telling people something that at a deep level they already know. We're telling people something that nobody among those who are suffering is truly contesting anymore. Yet there is something that people don't know, which is whether or not anything better is possible for them and their loved ones, whether or not they or anyone can attain anything better. Addressing that question is today's pressing need, a task to which we haven't been giving enough attention. In today's environments, considerably less time should be spent on explaining to people just how big and powerful the system is and enumerating all the manifold ways that it hurts us. Most often, enumerating the ills is not inspiring or anger-provoking as it once was, but is instead just depressing, debilitating, and deadening. This is not to say that we should avoid clarifying how institutions work, but to do only that doesn't inspire sustained activity. The real obstacle to movement building in the United States is not a widespread notion that everything is fine, but the idea that despite how bad things are, nothing better is possible. We need to convey some understanding of a better system, some understanding of how to reach it. Indeed, enough of both to provide hope, grounding, and positive orientation for ourselves and those who are joining our movements. As folks become radical, as they see the systemic roots of limitations on people's lives, and as they vow to uproot those roots, what is a broad vision for change in the United States? What is a compelling strategy for reaching it? Strategy is an accumulation of tactics. We meld tactics together into something that we might call campaigns. These campaigns meld together into something that we might call a scenario of change. These scenarios involve people who are the agents of change engaging in struggle. They also involve structures that we use to express our powers and organize our energies. So a strategy is going to be some conception that combines an understanding of who's going to make change, in what kinds of numbers, with what kinds of structures and organizational forms they will work in, with what kinds of issues they will fight over, and with what tactics they're going to use, with how they're going to combine all those tactics into campaigns, and with how these campaigns are going to not only better people's lives now, but also lead in time to new institutions. That's what strategy is all about. We don't win all at once, but in the sequence of steps. We continually win new gains along a road that leads to fundamental change. How do we win new gains along that road? We raise the social cost of not granting the gains we seek until such point as those who don't want to give in to our demands have no choice but to do so. Change is a combination of a sequence of reforms or limited victories that string together into a pattern in which we continually alter the contours of the world that we live in, making ourselves stronger and making those who oppose change weaker, until, ultimately, change accelerates and we win basic alterations. What might a winning strategy look like? Think back to the 1960s when we had various powerful movements that, at the time, were doing some of what I have described. The women's movement at one point not only critiqued sexism, but looked toward replacing specific institutions. It questioned traditional marriage. It questioned the isolated nuclear family. It tried to come up with alternatives emphasizing collective arrangements of parenting rather than sex role-defined mothering and fathering. In the 1960s, anti-racist movements questioned the basic composition of our culture, the ways in which communities form and relate to one another, and proposed alternatives based on mutual respect that was at the time called intercommunalism. Anarchists and youth movement activists tried to figure out just exactly what a polity needed to do and how it could be done without engendering authoritarianism, while encouraging autonomy, collective responsibility, and participation. Other labor activists and young militants began to challenge society's economic logic, its property relations, even for some, its corporate divisions of labor. And then emerged movements challenging relations to nature, ecological logic, and calculus. Various movements in the 1960s and 1970s not only critiqued existing reality, but attempted to develop a positive program for what they wanted in the future. Later, actually only a blink of an eye later in history, but quite a while in the lives of many people involved, the Rainbow Coalition formed. Suppose the Rainbow Coalition had been a little clearer in its conception and seen itself as the greatest common sum of all those independent movements, those autonomous movements, already in existence. Autonomous movements existed then and will exist as well in the future because people propelled by the situations they find themselves in will create such movements organized around specific areas of society that they must engage with. We will continue to see labor, women's, ecology, anti-racist, gay, peace, and other movements. Yet none of them can win alone. That was the Rainbow message. Suppose the concept of the Rainbow Coalition had been very clear about the need to be the greatest common sum of all its parts, rather than the least common denominator. Not a coalition, but a solidaritous bloc, let's say. Not a coalition in which you take whatever everybody can agree on, and you focus on that limited agenda, but a new type of encompassing structure, in which you take the entire agenda of each component part, even where they don't agree, and make the whole the encompassing agenda of the project, even though the various component parts may have disagreements with aspects of the whole agenda. In this new type of conflicted but encompassing and solidaristic whole, we all find ourselves in a bigger structure that has an agenda that we don't all entirely agree with, but which we stick with despite differences because we all respect each of its component movements and their insights, and thus what each component adds to the agenda. Suppose we did that for our overarching movement, and we had the autonomous movements within it as well, and a process by which we try to learn to refine and develop the overall agenda and have it inform all the component movements. Suppose we were also forming institutions in our communities, grassroots organization of the people who live in communities, to begin to conceive of what it would be like to take some control over their own lives where they live. And suppose we were doing the same thing in workplaces as well, forming councils of workers who are beginning to conceive of what it would be like to control their own situation and workplaces. In both of these cases, communities and workplaces, suppose, now looking to the future, these type new structures fight for improvements and changes, both to make life better now and also to increase their organizational strength and support for building toward still more improvements in the future. Suppose we develop all these aspects of activism simultaneously, and we fight to win new types of affirmative action, Fight to win increased wages, but not increases in the price of products. Or fight to curtail dumping, limit pollution, eliminate fossil fuel use, win full employment, to curb globalization and military interventions, to win new access to local and national decision-making influence, and to win gains around other gender, race, political, economic, and ecological issues. And suppose over time this whole movement of movements begins to address and to incorporate wider and wider sectors of people. Can anyone really deny that that unfolding process could win? But how could we build a movement such as this? Well, first, there are some obvious ways that a movement clearly doesn't grow. It doesn't grow if it creates a culture inside itself that is hostile to the people who it's trying to organize. We're not going to have that whole aroused left get larger and larger and larger until it involves 35 or 40% of the population or more, with the rest mostly just standing by the side and a few opposing it if we are antagonizing most citizens. Those are the rough conditions we need to win really transcendent changes. And we're not going to be able to do that if the movement we build has a culture hostile to working people. If, for example, we have a culture that reflects the attributes of a law school instead of a working class bar. Such a movement is not going to welcome into active membership 40% of the population. Being class elitist will hinder its growth among working people in the same way having a movement whose culture, dynamics, structure, and behavior are grossly sexist or grossly racist will hinder growth among women, blacks, and Latinx communities. Our movement doesn't have to be literally antagonistic to critical constituencies to fail. All it has to be is uncongenial enough that it will be uncomfortable and disempowering for centrally important sectors of the population, be it the working class, women, racial groups, or religious groups. We can't begin to reach a truly winning sector of people in the United States if our movements are unwelcoming to these constituencies. So it follows that the kind of movement we need to develop is one that's inclusive, which means that it has to respect and grow out of the attitudes, beliefs, and behavior patterns of real people in society, not out of some hypothesized, abstract, perfect people, or worse, out of a tiny, narrow sector of people with unusual advantages. Yet at the same time, this broad project also has to move toward creating the new kinds of values and modes of interrelating that broader audiences desire. This can and even is starting to happen. Will it continue? That is not a question about nature or about existing institutions. It is a question about people's choices, and thus a question for people's choices to answer. Post-COVID, post-Trump, becoming radical anew and embarking on literally transforming society to its core is our task, both to survive and to thrive. Revolution Z tries to present information, accounts, and potential vision and strategy on behalf of such positive choices. But Revolution Z needs help. It needs promotion, making it known to new audiences. And it needs financial aid as well. I hope you, our current listeners, will see clear to assist Revolution Z. It is a tiny thing to do in the grand scheme of things we need to do, to be sure. But having a podcast that prioritizes vision and strategy for winning a new world, that is not nothing, even if it is also not everything. So please help. One way to help is telling others of its merits. Another way is to visit our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/revolutionz. There you can access past episodes, which is also possible on ZNet and via various podcast helps, like Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Buzzsprout. But from the Patreon page, you can also provide us some material aid. Finally, here comes Election Day. And after Election Day, honestly, we don't know what. But what we do know, what is really rather uncomplicated, is that on the one hand we have to battle Trumpism if it retains authority, and on the other hand, if we succeed in removing Trump from office, we have to battle Biden. And in both situations, we ought to consider being radical in the sense we have today discussed. We ought to seek benefits for those in need now, but also seek a path toward winning new institutions that transform life as we know it into life as it ought to be. And that said, this is Michael Albert, signing off until next time for Revolution Z.